We are in the midst of a fairly dramatic cultural and religious sea change in the country, and it's one, though, that has gone a little under the radar of most Americans.
The numbers are substantial. America is changing, especially when it comes to religion.
We had crossed this threshold just in the last 10 years that we had gone, demographically speaking, from being a majority white Christian country to being a minority white Christian country.
So what are you thinking? Are you part of the change?
My name is Kara from Boston. I'm still a Bible-believing Christian and have been for the past 20-plus years. The biggest change today from a decade ago is how I choose to describe myself to others. I avoid terms like evangelical and Baptist.
Hi, this is Jane in Boston. I was brought up Catholic, and I still hold aspects of that theology, but being around people who identify as Christian makes me nervous.
And how about this listener from Portland, Oregon, who texted us, I began practicing Buddhism in 1998 as a college student. It's been a source of resilience for the 20 years that I've followed it. And we got another message from Framingham, Massachusetts. Been an atheist for the past 30 years and don't see that changing.
Hi, this is Pam Lindsay. I'm calling from Richardson, Texas. Unfortunately, it's unpopular to be a Christian these days, particularly ones who believe in the sanctity of life as the Bible teaches. It seems like we're supposed to be tolerant of all religions these days, unless you're a Christian.
I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and all this week we're talking about identity. Today, you guessed it, the spotlight is on religion. Robert P. Jones, who you heard at the top, is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, a nonpartisan, nonprofit research organization, and he's the man with the data. The Institute's 2016 American Values Atlas was the single largest survey of American religious and denominational identity ever conducted, surveying more than 100,000 Americans from all 50 states. So what did they find?
So if you go back to 2008, 54% of the country was white and Christian. By our last election cycle in 2016, that number had dropped to 43%, and we have one more year of data after that, now from 2017, and it dropped another percentage point to 42%. So it's been dropping about a percentage point a year over the last decade, and we've moved from this majority white Christian nation to one that is no longer a majority white Christian nation.
What about black and brown Christian America?
Yeah, you know, the story of how our religious landscape is shifting is fairly complex. Among African-American Christians, we see relative stability over this same period of time, making up about 1 in 10 Americans. And then we see this steady growth among Latino Christians, both Catholic and Protestant, in the country over the same period of time.
I mean, there's obviously another group of Americans who don't identify religiously at all. What do those numbers tell us?
That's right. So one question is, where are all those white Christians going, right, if there's this decline? And the short answer is the other group in the landscape that is growing are the ranks of the religiously unaffiliated. And it's been really only in the last few decades that we can measure this. As late as the 1990s, the number of Americans who claim no religious affiliation was in the single digits. In our last survey, we are finding that it is a quarter of Americans who now claim no religious affiliation. And one other clue as to what's going on, if you look at younger Americans, that is those under the age of 30, the number who claim no religious affiliation is 40%.
40%. Wow, that's pretty that's pretty stunning, actually.
You know, it is stunning, and it's something quite new. People in their 20s are always a little bit less religiously affiliated than older Americans. They tend to be more mobile, and especially as people have delayed marriage and having kids. That historically has coincided with affiliating with a religious institution. So, for example, if you take the baby boomers and you put them back in their 20s, less than 15% of them are unaffiliated in their 20s. So that means that this generation is doing something quite different than we've seen other generations doing. And so even if some percentage of those reaffiliated in their 30s as they have kids and settle down, this will still be the most religiously unaffiliated generation we've ever seen.
Are those that remain in the faith sort of doubling down on their faith?
You know, that's right. That's what we're seeing, is we're seeing a shrinking of those numbers. And just to, you know, put a fine point on white evangelical Protestants who are the core of President Trump's base, if we go back two election cycles ago, they're nearly a quarter of the population, 23% of the population back in 2006 to 2008. But in our last survey, just among white evangelicals, they've dropped to 15% of the population. And they're losing mostly younger members who tend to be, for example, more liberal on LGBT rights, more behind climate change, a number of things that the Republican Party has become associated with opposing. And so they're losing members on the younger side, which means that the core group that's left tends to be older and more conservative, and in a sense, tend to be also more politically conservative and really behind President Trump.
What about geographic differences? We often talk about the Bible Belt, for example. Is the Bible Belt still a Bible Belt?
Well, you know, it is. You know, there's only six states today, if we're talking about LGBT rights, this is one interesting way of thinking about this. There's only six states today where majorities oppose same-sex marriage, and they do tend to be concentrated in the South and the old Bible Belt. Having said that, if you look at these demographic changes, and we're not just thinking about political attitudes, but demographic changes, one of the interesting things we can do, because we have data for all 50 states over time, is you can just go back just a few years and look at the differences state by state. And in every state, these demographic changes I'm talking about the decline of white Christians, the rise of Latino Protestants, the rise of the unaffiliated, those same dynamics are at work in every state across the country. And you can, when you do like a heat map and you look at one 10 years ago and today, you can see not just in California and in New York or in big urban areas, but even in Iowa, Kansas, Mississippi, you see these same dynamics at work all across the country.
We had a guest on earlier this week talking about the increase in the Latino population in Kansas, for example. Really, really interesting. I want to ask you about, we're seeing a lot of the president's agenda right now is being shaped by his evangelical base, right? Is this shift that you're noting in less affiliated, religiously affiliated Americans, do you think that's going to have any impact on our policies going forward?
Well, we certainly are seeing it bleed over into even how our two political parties are composed. So again, if you go back just, and it's very fast changes. That's the thing about this. All the changes I'm talking about are really changes that have moved very quickly just in a decade. And in terms of demographics, that's very fast. Usually demographic changes are kind of glacial things that, you know, take decades and decades. And we're seeing big changes just over one decade. So just another example, the two parties are kind of sorting themselves as these demographic changes are happening and getting further apart. And that's driving political polarization. So the Republican Party, for example, is kind of doubling down and is increasingly becoming the party of white Christians in the country. So 10 years ago, they were composed about 8 in 10 of white Christian Americans. Today, they're still more than 7 in 10 white Christian Americans, even as the country is shifting. Democrats, on the other hand, those identify with the Democratic Party, are shifting with the country's composition. So 10 years ago, about half of Democrats were white and Christian. Today, only about 3 in 10 are white and Christian, and a quarter, nearly as many, are religiously unaffiliated.
Now, just because someone doesn't identify with a specific faith, right, doesn't say, for example, I am a Catholic, that doesn't necessarily mean that that person isn't grounded in some sort of faith or spiritual belief system, correct?
Only about a quarter of that group claims to be atheist or agnostic. And in fact, about 1 in 8 say that they actually are still consider themselves a religious person, even though they're not formally affiliated with any tradition.
And does that signal to you some sort of morality?
You know, here's the interesting thing about the morality question. I think a lot of, you know, people who see, particularly religious people who see this decline in religiosity, the rise in disaffiliation or being unaffiliated, are worried because they take the next step and link it to a decline of morality in the country. And historically, the U.S. has been a very, very religious country and has made that link. But when we ask people in surveys about a question, for example, about whether or not you need to be religious in order to be moral, we're also seeing a generational break in that question. Like, overwhelmingly, seniors in the country link these two things very, very tightly and say, yes, in order to be moral, you have to be religious. We had a survey question that we asked in 2011 where we asked about candidates' character. And the question said that whether a elected official could behave immorally in their private life and yet still carry out their duties and act morally in their public life. In 2011, only 30% of white evangelicals said this was possible, agreed with this statement. And that's what you would expect from a group that had branded itself as quote-unquote values voters, right, that were all about character. Now, we asked this question again in 2016, and remarkably, 72% of evangelicals now agree with this statement, that you can build kind of a moral wall between one's private life and one's public life. And,
now, I want to insert a little data point here, too. In 2011, we had a black president. In 2016, we don't. And I'm wondering if that morality scale that you're talking about had anything to do with race.
You know, I think that's right. And you know, one of the things that, as an observer of kind of the white evangelical, you know, movement over across President Obama's presidency, what was interesting about their reactions was that there was actually a bigger reaction in 2012 to President Obama's re-election than there even was to his original election in 2008. And there was, I think, this sense that, okay, well, if he was elected once, that's sort of one thing. Maybe it was a fluke. But this kind of, you know, handily re-elected thing, a two-term president where, you know, his legitimacy is kind of beyond question at that point, it was quite something. And you did see reactions from people like Tony Perkins and the Family Research Council and the kind of conservative Christian right sending out real missives that were very visceral and apocalyptic, really, even saying, pray for us that God will protect us from those enemies without and within who seek for America to be destroyed. That was the language in something right after Barack Obama was reelected in 2012. Now, so there's no question that race is playing a role here.
And I feel like this is a bit where we get into the hypocrisy of this this particular group in that we're talking about. I just cannot imagine, if similar allegations had been lobbed against President Obama of infidelity, of porn stars, that the religious right in particular would have granted him a quote-unquote mulligan. But that's just me.
Yeah. Well, I think it's clear that white evangelicals have essentially traded, you know, their efforts at branding themselves as values voters and have become what I was calling nostalgia voters, right? So they let the values thing go by the wayside. And they've really doubled down on a candidate that is at least promising them to turn back the clock to a time where they had more power and where they felt like the country was more with them than it is today. But that's a fairly desperate move, in my opinion. Now, really, what you see is white evangelicals being the champion of basically a consequentialist ethic where the ends justify the means.
Robert P. Jones, the author of The End of White Christian America, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Keeping on the subject of faith, let's head to France now. In March, Mireille Knoll, a Holocaust survivor, was stabbed to death in her Paris apartment and then set on fire. One of the suspects allegedly yelled Allahu Akbar while killing her. It was one of the most violent recent anti-Semitic crimes in France. And, like many French presidents before him, Emmanuel Macron recently called for a full reform of Islam in France. And now tensions around this issue have risen after 300 prominent French politicians and intellectuals published a manifesto in the French paper Le Parisien. It calls for changes to the Quran, including eliminating verses that incite violence. The Muslim community in France and around the world is outraged. Minaz Afridi is here to explain. She's the director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center at Manhattan College and also an associate professor there. Minaz, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about who these powerful voices are behind the manifesto. Who are these people and what exactly are they calling for?
Well, I mean, these people are, you know, both the ex-Prime Minister Sarkozy, and then there's also Michael Walls, who actually heard recently in Jerusalem at the Global Summit, and a bunch of intellectuals, people who work against anti-Semitism. But they're mainly politicians, people in the light in terms of being known in France. And they're calling for something which I think is not helpful, nor is it useful in terms of the issues of anti-Semitism in France, which is to really take away, extract verses from the Quran that they feel are violent and are compelling Muslims in France to attack Jews.
My initial reaction to this was that it felt paternalistic, somewhat colonial. Is it? And does this come from a similar place as the movement to ban headscarves and veils? Or is this a justified concern and fear?
One of the things we have to recognize is France is a country of a population of 67 million. And there are only 495,000 Jews, which is actually the majority in terms of Europe. And then you have, in terms of the Muslim population, 4.7 million Muslims. That is the population equivalent of the United Arab Emirates. So here you have sort of a sketch, right? You have some statistics in front of you. And then you ask yourself, well, what's going on here? Well, I mean, there's a history in terms of France colonization, but there's also a history of how Muslim immigrants were not assimilated. They were living in places called banlieues, which are ghettos. Actually, under Sarkozy, which is a very long time after the immigration of Muslims, they decided to teach Muslim immigrants French. I think that's kind of very slow. And I also feel that there is a ghettoization of Muslims. And this is not just to help Jews, but this is sort of saying, I don't want you here. I don't want your Quran here. I don't want your Islam here. So what I'm going to do is change it because you can't control yourself. You are these barbaric people. And I think that's very offensive to Muslims. And, you know, I'm someone who works on anti-Semitism as a Muslim. I agree there is anti-Semitism in my community, in France. It's a big problem. But I think that taking away a sacred text, the word of God, from Muslims is very, very destructive. And this will only create more violence.
Well, let's talk about the text. What verses is the manifesto actually referencing?
You know, they're not very clear about that, but they're referencing verses that talk about unbelievers. They're referencing verses that talk about defense. They're referencing verses talking about Jews and Christians. And they're referencing verses that are really talking to everybody. These verses in context historically and also in terms of looking at how Islam talks to Jews, Muslims, and Christians is talking about unbelievers. An unbeliever could be a Muslim. An infidel could be a Muslim. As a matter of fact, that's why a lot of the extremist groups kill mainly Muslims. We become the victims of not just extremism, but also this sort of secular, liberal, colonial mindset that comes back and says, well, this is sort of the fault of every Muslim.
Let's talk a little bit about how different the Quran is from other sacred texts like the Bible. Does it actually call for violence in different or more prominent ways than other religious texts that we're perhaps more familiar with?
I just taught a course in religion and violence. And one of the things we looked at is religions starting with Hinduism all the way to Islam, including Sikhism and including Buddhism. I mean, today we have a really dire situation in Myanmar where the Rohingya are being persecuted by Buddhists. And that philosophy is actually based on theology. It's what they believe in terms of the cycle of violence within Buddhism. If we look at Christianity, we don't look too far, but we always talk about the Crusades. I mean, the Crusades were built on this idea of salvation. According to the Bible, I am basically a heathen because I don't accept Christ as my salvation. So are Jews. Jews were blamed for deicide, and they were killed repeatedly and persecuted because they were blamed of deicide within the Christian Bible. Now, do I want to say to Christians or, you know, this school that I teach at Manhattan College to my Catholic colleagues that, you know, you need to change the Bible? No, absolutely not. Because I think what Catholicism does is what Islam does, is talks about, you know, the messages of justice and love and peace and suffering and forgiveness. And in Judaism, also you see violence. You see violence at the time of Moses. You know, Moses can escape, but other people get killed. Or you see in the book of Esther. You know, book of Esther is a heroine, but also other people are killed. So Jews are allowed to kill. There is a certain kind of compunction in these texts that will allow anyone to pick them up, literalize them, simplify them, and take it somewhere else.
I mean, I guess a fundamental question is, can the Quran be edited? And if so, by whom?
I mean, the Quran is, for us Muslims, the standing miracle of Islam. This is the only miracle that came with Prophet Muhammad. We believe in the miracles of Moses, and we believe in the miracles of Jesus. But for Prophet Muhammad, this to us was the miracle. It came from God to Gabriel to Muhammad. It is the immutable word of God. It is something very sacred. I mean, we're coming up on Ramadan. The duty of every Muslim in the world is to reread the Quran. Why? Some of us memorize it. Some of us have read it 100 times. But the purpose is to find new meanings, is to find new ways of thinking about what the Quran is saying. Because in Islam, just like in Judaism and Christianity, one can never really know what God was really saying. And the whole mystery and the whole idea of faith is to try to decipher that.
Manaz Afridi is Associate Professor and Director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center at Manhattan College. Her book is titled Shoah Through Muslim Eyes, which is all about her journey with Judaism as a Muslim. Manaz, a pleasure having you with us, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Takeaway listeners, pardon this interruption of the regularly scheduled programming for a really important announcement. We've been reading your tweets and comments and posts all during Tanzina's first week at The Takeaway, and we want to give you, the listeners, a chance to take your questions to Tanzina directly. On Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, The Takeaway is hosting a Facebook Live with Tanzina, moderated by On the Media's Brooke Gladstone. It's an opportunity to ask us about the show, about this never-ending news cycle, and you can give us suggestions about what story The Takeaway should cover next. What stories are important to you? You can head over to our social media pages Monday morning for links to the event. We are on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook as well. We hope to see you there for a behind-the-scenes chat with Tanzina and Brooke, Monday, 1 p.m. Eastern.
Have you been following along with the thread on Essential Consultants, Michael Cohen's LLC, you know, President Trump's personal lawyer? Well, it turns out that Essential Consultants LLC does more than just make payments to Stormy Daniels. This week, there's new information regarding payments to the shell company. And among the revelations, payments from large companies like AT&T and Novartis for a contract that began shortly after Trump's inauguration. And there's also a payment made between January and August of last year from Columbus Nova. Who are they? An investment bank firm linked to Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg. The firm made a payment of $500,000 to Cohen's shell company. In total, the transactions amount to at least $4.4 million. Steve Portnoy of CBS Radio asked White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders about the payments yesterday.
Michael Cohen received millions of dollars, apparently peddling the insights that he said he could provide into this administration to America's largest corporations. Is the president in any way embarrassed or ashamed of that? Because it seems to be the definition of swampy behavior.
I think that would be up to those individuals who make the decision to hire someone. That's the decision of an independent company and has nothing to do with the White House.
Ilya Marritz and Andrea Bernstein are journalists for WNYC and hosts of the Trump Inc. podcast. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hey.
So let's break this down. We just heard Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying that these payments have nothing to do with the White House.
Well, I think it's clear these payments have everything to do with the White House. So we'll go back to January 2017. Michael Cohen does not get a White House job, which he'd hoped for. So he begins to go around and effectively sell his knowledge. I think that's the most charitable way to say it, of the Trump's thinking about things. And he is allowed explicitly at this time by the president to put personal attorney to President Donald J. Trump in his email signature. So he can send emails out to all of these people and they can see that. And it doesn't take a neurosurgeon to figure out what that means when you get an email like that. Hey, do you want to hire me? And he apparently found quite a few takers, including some Fortune 500 companies.
And what's really striking here is some of these companies were paying him like quite big money. So this guy who has never been a lobbyist before, he's not affiliated with any lobbying company, he's not registered as a lobbyist, all of a sudden he becomes the top paid outside consultant at Novartis. Stat News reported that today. And you just think, well, what is the expertise that Michael Cohen brought to this? The only thing he had to offer was his relationship with President Trump.
So apparently that's what we're talking about here. Is this a pay to play, essentially? Did he offer access? Is that what he's getting paid for?
Well, clearly the company said. One Novartis official was telling people yesterday that they were, in fact, seeking access. In the official statements, they said they were seeking an understanding of the president. They were seeking insight into the president. But it's really important to understand here, and I think this point is kind of confusing, Essential Consultants LLC was not a real company. It was a shell company. It had no employees. It had no infrastructure. There was no lobbying firm. Paul Manafort, currently under indictment for money laundering, actually was a lobbyist, had a lobbying firm. Michael Cohen just had his name and that email signature, private attorney to President Donald J. Trump, to sell. So I think it's a really important question. And in fact, Novartis sort of was like, well, he didn't really do anything for us, and so we didn't renew his contract, but we paid him anyway because we couldn't get out of it. So it looks like it was purely a way to get in with the Trump administration. And I think what is so striking about this story is everybody understands that that's what happens in the world. Even Donald Trump clearly understands it. But now actually what we're seeing is people are just sort of saying, like, yeah, that's what we were going for.
Now, just curious, I mean, the president, since the beginning, has made a big deal of the fact that he's a businessman, not a politician. So why, if he's such a businessman, why do these big companies need to pay for access to him? Wouldn't we assume that there's already an understanding of the president or a certain amount of access to the president within the business community?
I think the businessman thing is really interesting because he made a very consequential decision before taking office, which was not to divest himself of his own business. And on the Trump Inc. podcast, where Andrea and I are co-hosts, that's kind of the fundamental conflict that we are always exploring. So I think it's fair to say that when he made that decision to hang on to the Trump organization, this business that owns hotels and golf courses and a lot of properties in a lot of places, and he can continue, by the way, to draw income from that company, I think he sent an important signal, which is that we're not going to rigidly apply ethical rules and ethical standards. We're not going to demand, although we have said we will drain the swamp, we're also not going to do the things that would put up a clear, firm, big, beautiful wall between politics and business. In fact, politics and business, he sort of said they're a good fit for each other. So it's not entirely surprising. It's astonishing what has happened, but it's also not entirely surprising.
It's also consistent with Michael Cohen's past. We did an episode of Trump Inc. really doing a deep dive. And Michael Cohen had been a lawyer for taxi companies. He'd been somebody who represented people who were in traffic crashes and were seeking insurance money. And this was the kind of business dealing that he was in before Trump. And what was striking is that so many people around him were convicted of crimes, investigated, lost their professional licenses. And he sort of walked through life like that, setting up so many shell company after shell company. And it is there's one straight line from that to Essential Consultants, paying off Stormy Daniels, collecting money from a Russian oligarch-tied firm, all of which we now know happened.
There's also a lot on AT&T payments, which is in a bid for Time Warner, which directly affects media. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? Are these things connected to that?
Just look at the business that these companies were in. We have a pharma company. Donald Trump pledged to bring down pharmaceutical drug prices. We have a communications company. Federal communications policy is always a big deal, even if you aren't planning a merger. So, of course, these are companies that had business before the federal government all the time.
I was here talking with the Trump Inc. podcast team about the latest developments in Michael Cohen's shell company. Thanks, guys, for being with us today.
So great to be with you, and congratulations on your Takeaway debut.
Thank you. That's all for us today, folks. But before we go, please get out your calendars and mark this down. Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern, I'll be doing a Facebook Live session with none other than Brooke Gladstone from On the Media. You can ask me anything. Well, almost anything. Choose wisely, please. It will be on our Takeaway Facebook page, so go and like that page and join us on Monday. And if your question just can't wait until then, you can always find me on Twitter, at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.